This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research and activism.
Today, we're bringing you a brand new episode. We're excited to welcome back scholar, activist and Nine Dots Prize winner Joanna Kuziak, who will present her new book, Radically Legal, Berlin Constitutes the Future. The book tells the story of Deutsche Wohnen und Co. Enteignen, a groundbreaking grassroots movement that mobilized over a million Berliners to challenge a speculative housing market, increasingly dominated by multi-billion dollar corporations. By activating Article 15 of the Grundgesetz, a long-forgotten clause of the German Constitution, a group of ordinary citizens set out to expropriate and socialize 240,000 homes previously privatized by corporate landlords. As the movement now prepares for its second legislative referendum, Kuziak moves between interdisciplinary analysis and her personal story, exploring the vision of urban housing as a democratically held commons, and reveals how radically legal politics can strengthen democracy and revive the rules of law. This episode is produced in collaboration with the Think and Drink Colloquium for the Georg Simmel Center for Urban Studies at Humboldt University, Berlin. We hope you enjoy it.
It is actually tremendously important for me to share this book here because, I mean, it's I have been at Georg Simmel Zentrum in 2020 to 2022, and I was gathering material for this book. But also I was here in 2007 where I first moved from Poland to Berlin and where my Berlin adventure started. I attended Andre's seminar actually as a first in my first year. I will reveal later. I mean, in fact, this Think and Drink seminar has also played a very prominent role in this research. It's even mentioned in the book. I will read the relevant fragments later. If knowledge is power and if we produce some knowledge, then just as any kind of power, we should share this power and make sure that what we're writing reaches people and is understandable, that there isn't a shield of jargon protecting whatever finding that we have. And so in that spirit of readability, I think I will start by reading a small fragment in the book, and I will return and every now and then just read a little fragment to give you a sense of style, while also hoping to have exciting conversation with you about not just the book, but about Berlin and about Deutsche Wohnen und Co. Enteignen, which is the main protagonist of the book. But the book starts, in fact, right at the beginning after I came to Berlin. And it opens with a scene from the court where I took my landlord after he tried to, well, gentrify me and my roommates out of an apartment of a gear in Prenzlauer Berg. Spoiler alert, the apartment, I actually still lived there. Because Herr Meyer was yelling, I couldn't understand his exact words. Frau Tams, on the other hand, was speaking with soft confidence, folding words I understood perfectly into sentences that sounded baroquely mysterious. But sometimes we get to feel the implication of what is happening long before we can grasp it in words. That scorching summer, in a cool chamber of the administrative court in Berlin Mitte, Herr Meyer and I had both arrived at the same truth, one that neither of us really felt before, that I, too, was free. A student from Poland is not going to tell me what I can or cannot do with my property, Herr Meyer had told me a few weeks earlier. I had challenged his rent increase, and he had threatened to terminate my contract. When I saw him at his office with an oil-on-canvas painting of a red sports car right behind his head, I sensed that he took his power advantage for granted. Now, in court, his face was contorted with a furious grimace. I had written my master thesis on Walter Benjamin in Herr Meyer's apartment, and suddenly it occurred to me that my landlord must be experiencing what Benjamin called the mythical violence of the law. In his defense, he kept repeating the word Eigentümer, owner. Herr Meyer was the owner. And who was I? Amid the strange music of German legal jargon, I felt the mythical violence of the law burning new pathways through my identity. It was as if Frau Tams, a lawyer from the Berlin Tenants Association, Berliner Mietergemeinschaft, were casting spells on me. With her first spell, she turned a poor student into a legal subject. With her second spell, she turned a Polish migrant into a rightful Berliner. For her third spell, Frau Tams said nothing. She left me in a space where I could turn myself into whatever I wanted to be, because I was free. That scorching summer, the law completed in me a new notion of freedom. After years of just being free to go, Berlin had made me free to stay. This opening is tremendously important for me also because it was, the way I remember it, was a genuine moment of empowerment for me. I mean, indeed, back then as a Polish migrant, a poor student, I mean, I spoke German, but I knew nothing about the law. I knew nothing about the tenant rights. And obviously I was scared. And to experience in the court that even as a migrant without citizenship, without money, I have my right, and there's something that protects my right and upholds my rights as a tenant, was definitely a surprise to me. I mean, something I didn't expect, something I didn't know also from Poland. I mean, Poland does not have any properly protected tenant rights, and it definitely became a very key moment, both in my politicization into the housing movement. I mean, I was already active with housing movement in Warsaw, and I experienced also first-hand housing crisis in Warsaw as well. I describe it in the book as well, and it was also through this contrast of what is possible, what kind of freedom actually I get to experience, even in this relatively non-powerful status as a Berliner. It really changed something in me and became very dear to me and something that I became committed to protect. The book's title is Radically Legal because it is in a way about the adventure of radical politics and the law. I mean, radically legal means, I mean, the very word radical means to the roots. I mean, coming back to the roots. And the book is about generally, I mean, the history of the housing movement in Berlin, but in particular, in its volume, 90% maybe of it is about Deutsche Wohnen and Co. Enteignen. Just to get the basic, I mean, it is a Volksentscheid, a referendum that was organized in Berlin in 2021 by a movement that was very grassroots and very interestingly organized, as I will say in the later part of the project. The movement proposed to expropriate corporate landlords. So landlords, not just any kind of landlords, but mostly the housing that was privatized to private equity, financialized corporations. I mean, basically the housing that is being speculated with on the financial markets. And the legal ground for it was Article 15 of the Grundgesetz, the German basic law, that says that this is a short confession, but that basically land, means of production and natural resources could be, quote, socialized, the German word is Vergesellschaftung, through a law, I mean, with a compensation. And the purpose of it is to transform a sector of economy or a big chunk of goods. I mean, it cannot be single apartment, it needs to be big pool of apartments into Gemeineigentum. I mean, now again, Gemeineigentum or Gemeinwirtschaft, I mean, it's often translated into English as solidarity economy, but it's, to be honest, a very German term also of a distinct tradition. And just a very brief historic, I mean, so Article 15, I mean, its origins of the notion of Vergesellschaftung, socialization, dates back to the German Revolution. And it first appeared in the Weimar Constitution, and from there it made it to the Grundgesetz. What I think is very interesting and important, I think, in the context in which it may be back. I mean, in 1945, of course, very specific situation in Germany, rebuilding itself from Nazism. And back then, indeed both SPD, big chunk of the CDU, so not just the radical left, not just the communists, but also the social democrats and parts of the CDU, were very much in favor of this article. And one of the important arguments was a very fresh memory in which big business helped Hitler in rising to power. And the notion that is associated with it is the notion of Missbrauch wirtschaftliche Macht, so the misuse of economic power against democracy, against the well-being of the society. And it's a very interesting article, I mean, as probably many of you already know, because it has been completely forgotten. I mean, it hasn't been historically ever used. I mean, it's while at the same time having a very powerful legal status, because it has a status of the Grundrecht, I mean, the one of the fundamental laws. And it is, in my opinion, like one of the most innovative, I mean, one of the biggest legal innovations of Germany at all, that is unprecedented and it's just not present in this form in any other constitution. And many things that are special about it is, at first, I mean, that it is a fundamental right. It's the only fundamental right that is a collective right. Now, the whole liberal notion of legal rights actually rests very strongly of the idea of the individual. Whereas Article 15 and the right to socialization, it can only be realized collectively. So it's the right that is the right of the whole community. And therefore, it is a way in which the law recognizes that community is also a democratic unit. It's not just, in this sense, like it's a door. I mean, Wolfgang Abendroth, a prominent German socialist lawyer, I mean, has called it as a door to socialism in the German constitution. And indeed, it has been historically also perceived in this way, because it opens this ways for completely different thinking, both about the economy, but also about the notion of rights. So it's not just about the property, it's also about something more deeper and more fundamental, namely, how do we perceive the subject of right, and does it only has to be an individual? And then the second innovation, it was conceptualized in this time, in 1945, I mean, 1918 anyway, but even 1945, this idea of misuse of economic power was still very much conceptualized in the national frame. It was about German industry. And already then, there was this idea, I mean, the idea implied in it is that the notion of checks and balances, which again, one of the fundamentals of democracy, is that the different kinds of powers, right, executive, legislative, and so on, that they have to keep each other in check so that none of the power is misused for the authoritarian purposes, that these notions of checks and balance get also extended to the economic power. Because classically, in the theory of democracy, there is this free division of powers, right, that keeps each other in check. And here this notion gets extended also onto the economic power. So implied in this is the idea that also economic power can be misused against the democracy and needs to be curbed at times for the well-being of democracy. Now, it's one thing to say that it was radical in 1945, although actually it wasn't perceived as radical back then, but rather as a rather commonsensical idea. But in the age of Elon Musk, in the age of big corporations, where it's very clear that some of these corporations have capital that extends the economic power of several small countries, this idea that this is a power that needs to be curbed in order to uphold democracy, of course, has a completely different meaning. Now, just to remind, I'm sure most of you also know, what is the current status of Deutsche Wohnen & Co. and Eignen. Namely, we did win the referendum in 2021 with nearly 60% of the votes. I say we also because I was very much involved with the initiative. I mean, especially during the campaign, the referendum campaign, I also served as one of its spokespersons. So I did research with and on the initiative and also tried to contribute in turn whatever I could. So we won the referendum, but it was, as you surely know, never implemented. And it was not implemented because the referendum that we won, I mean, A, because the government didn't want it. I mean, the most simple answer. I mean, first Franziska Giffey from the SPD and now Kai Wegner, I mean, obviously they never tried to hide that they're not interested even remotely in implementing the results of the referendum. And the referendum that the initiative proposed back then initially was a referendum that is not legally binding. Within the law of Berlin as a state, there are two referenda that are possible. It's a Beschlussvolksentscheid and Gesetzvolksentscheid, so the resolution referendum and the legislative referendum. The resolution referendum, the one that we already won, just orders the government to legislate based on clearly expressed wish of the society to legislate. But it has no legal, it's not legally binding, which means there's, if the government really doesn't want to do it, there's no means to enforce it. They can delay, postpone, deny, do all kinds of strategies, and they did all of them and keep doing. And then there's a legislative referendum where you propose a legislation project. It needs to be legally checked. And then if one wins such a referendum, then the results of it would be automatically implemented. And so 2 years after the one referendum that we already did won, the initiative announced that there will be a second referendum. So at first crowdfunded a big chunk of money, I mean over 100,000 euros, and then found a legal prominent public law firm that is now still writing the legislation. Obviously, it's a task that was neither interesting for the media because it's not spectacular, but it's tremendously important because such a legislation would be under heavy political attack. I mean, it's clear that, you know, Constitutional Court, everyone would try to find a formal mistake in this legislation to make it possible. So it's very important to really bulletproof it as much as one can, because law is a matter of interpretation. There's no ultimate bulletproofing, but there's things that one can do. And the plan is that there would be, then the whole thing would start anew, so that there would be another referendum, the Gesetzvolksentscheid, and so maybe also you all get again to sign for the referendum or help collecting signatures. And, you know, it is a bit like this joke about the French Revolution. What are the results of French Revolution? We are yet to see, is the answer. And, you know, considering that that this clause, you know, that first it was fought for in the German Revolution, then it was fought for by the mother and fathers of the Grundgesetz, then it was fought for in the first referendum under this tremendous amount of energy, and in history, of course, one has to be, as Gramsci says, you know, it's a pessimism of intellect, but always optimism of the will. Namely, the fact that this clause is in the constitution means that it's technically and legally still possible. And also, just speaking of legal possibilities, one of the deny delay move that was organized by the mayor Franziska Giffey after she didn't want to implement a referendum was to organize a commission, the expert commission, to investigate, is it really legally possible? I mean, Andre was also prominently involved. And even if this commission was actually politically motivated as a means to not implement the Volksentscheid, actually, despite the dissenting votes and so on, the bulk of this legal expertise, I mean, confirmed that it would be very well possible. I mean, it's definitely legally possible. And if it's politically possible, we are yet to see. Now, more about my book and about my focus. I mean, the book is titled Radically Legal because I looked especially closely at the role of law. And the full story of how I came to this research on Deutsche, maybe actually it's a moment that I read you another fragment because it's a bit of a deja vu to be in this room. I'm a sociologist, so this is very personal. I mean, I'm a sociologist, but got heavily involved into the study of law and legal technicalities. I never wanted to study law, and formally I never did. Where I come from, poor kids studied law to stop being poor, and rich kids studied law because it was what their parents did. I wanted to understand the world, so I studied philosophy and social sciences. I also never planned to become a scholar activist. It is a label that was given to me only after I left Poland. In Warsaw, most of my university professors had been involved with the Solidarność movement. Engaging with reality was considered a crucial aspect of intellectual education. From a close family member who runs a public philosophy seminar in a small town attended by artists and shopkeepers alike, I learned that thinking can also be a form of public service. In Berlin, I chose to turn thinking into a living. I became an academic. But once I settled into my Berlin freedom, the brutality of the Polish shock therapy, which is the context in which I grew up, I mean, the shock therapy, I mean, I was born 1985, so the bulk of my childhood is a very, very brutal economic shock therapy, struck me with renewed force. I returned to Warsaw as a researcher, determined to make sense of the many urban crises triggered by privatization and deregulation, a state-driven dismantling of the state. People called this overlapping crisis chaos because it felt as if a blind force had taken control of our city. But the more data I collected, the clearer it became that this chaos was organized into multiple orders of profit-driven dispossession. I teamed up with Warsaw's social movements to analyze what later became known as Reprivatization Gate, Poland's most spectacular case of legal corruption. In the early 2010s, Warsaw was losing ground, literally and for real. Thousands of tenants were being evicted as the buildings were allegedly being restituted to the historical owners dispossessed by the communist regime, and the budgetary crisis was looming because of the scale of the compensation claims. But the odd thing was this. The parliament never legislated property restitution because of Warsaw's complicated history. After the city was razed to the ground by the Nazis, the people rebuilt it in a collective effort on a different urban grid with public funding. What was nationalized in 1945 was a pile of rubble. What was now to be returned was critical public infrastructure, schools, university buildings, public parks, and housing. The issue was simply too contentious. More than 20 proposed restitution bills were rejected, and one after the other by consecutive parliaments of various political colors. By the time the legal corruption behind Reprivatization Gate was finally exposed, by activists, journalists, and scholars working hand in hand to crack open the legal black box, it was too late. Warsaw's stolen land had been laundered, just as the law is able to launder drug money by passing it through a chain of legitimate transactions. Warsaw's best apartments, rebuilt by the people under state socialism, then stolen through the law under, or rather despite, democracy, had become clean investment properties. In 2016, sitting in one such investment apartment in Warsaw, I drafted a proposal for a research project that underlies the book that you are now reading or hearing. The apartment had been rented for me through a well-known online portal by an institution that had invited me to speak at a conference about, ironically, the Polish housing crisis. I immediately recognized the building from my own research. It was very clean and expensive. All the apartments had been converted into offices and temporary rentals. Architecturally, this Warsaw short-term rental was much like my Berlin home, an early 20th century tenement with spacious rooms and high ceilings. And in each case, the current status of both these apartments was the result of the way legal fiction had played out politically within judicial proceedings. The Warsaw tenants had been evicted through legal fictions. I, through legal fictions, was able to stay in Berlin. So here was my project: to explore and democratize the discrete politics of legal fictions. Crafting legal fictions is a standard legal procedure, but the more the technical jargon of the law conceals these operations, the easier it becomes to smuggle power agendas into the law. Once this mechanism was exposed, the inner politics of the law could be democratized without forfeiting the law's systemic independence. The lawyers would still make decisions about the terms of the legal systems, but while the lawyers work the letters of the law, the people can protect its spirit. I planned to work closely with the Berlin tenants' unions, learning how lawyers like Frau Tanz make strategic use of legal technicalities in defending tenants. In January 2017, I pitched this project to King's College, Cambridge, which agreed to fund it. In May 2018, halfway through my maternity leave, I gave a talk about my project at the Humboldt University of Berlin. And this was here, this was the Think and Drink. I argued that we had to reclaim the law as a democratic tool for social change. A student approached me afterwards, asking if I had heard of the campaign that had just been launched, Deutsche Wohnen and Co. and Eigen. So this is how much I owe to Think and Drink. I mean, indeed, for me, the trajectory of this project was that I did conceive this project about how to use the law politically. And the moment I got funding and I gave this talk here, someone told me about Deutsche Wohnen and Co. and Eigen, and in a way, this is like the biggest case of research luck that I ever tapped into. Namely, I mean, here it was, like an incredibly ambitious initiative that uses law to, in some ways, you can say, like organize a revolution, but the revolution not against the law, but just from inside of the legal system. Again, if radical means going back to the roots, I mean, radically legal means a revolution that goes back to the root of the legal system and to the roots of democracy. And I think what I find particularly impressive about the initiative is its mixture, I mean, how it in a way amalgates and combines the whole many different pools of knowledge that Berlin has as a city that historically has always been politicized and has always been politicized about housing. And the city that in a way conceived its freedom also for this idea that everyone can live there relatively affordably and therefore can realize their basic freedom, become who they want to be. And I mean, the first, I think, most important element of the legal strategy is the way the movement combines the political and the legal strategy. So on the one hand, and this you can see even on the level of naming. I mean, on the one hand, it is called expropriate Deutsche Wohnen. So and that is a negative political claim. You can say it's about getting the bad guys, and everyone knows it's much easier to organize for this negative against the bad guys agenda. But at the same time, what it really proposes is this Vergesellschaftung, and Vergesellschaftung is not just the transfer of property, but it's actually a deeply systemic intervention. So in a way, the movement is sneaky in a way that it smuggles a very positive system building agenda into anti-systemic agenda. In this case, this is a movement, I mean, in this sense, I often say that this is a movement is both anti-systemic and pro-systemic. It's anti-systemic in a way that it seriously challenges the neoliberal system as we know it. But it's pro-systemic because it challenges it not to smash the system, not to destroy the system, in fact, to save the system from being smashed and destroyed by this dominance of financial capital. So that's the one thing. I mean, the second, I mean, it combines this legal expertise, I mean, and thinking about the law, writing legislation, thinking about very deeply how a new institution would look like. So the movement proposes not just the transfer of property, but also the whole project of how a new housing institution would work. I mean, it creates, I mean, the Anstalt öffentliche Rechte, AÖR, I mean, a proposition of the new institution. And really, if you go to the webpage of the movement and download materials, it conceptualizes very, very deeply how this new housing institution would work. I mean, how to solve conflict around the housing distribution, how to make sure that you uphold many different goals, ecological goals, social justice goals, you know, renovation goals, all kinds of goals, how to really balance it. And there's also a very systematic thought of how to divide power in the institution, how to distribute housing, how to prevent also this institution from internal corruption. And that, again, I find particularly impressive. And the ultimate sign of the maturity of the movement, that the type of checks and balance that are built in this vision in a way also show a signs that the movement is trying to prevent also its own corruption. I mean, it's not the idea that here are the bad guys and here we are the good guys and we're coming and take over and everything will be fine. I mean, the people who are involved in the movement, involved in this conceptualization, have experience in, you know, institutional politics, has its experience in activism, has experience in law, and understands that there is no such things as good guys or bad guys. There is only checks and balance. And by the mixture of representative politics and direct engagement, I mean, how to make sure that such institution would not be taken over by any particular fraction, and also how to make sure that it represents the whole population of Berlin, that also this doesn't become a club, I mean, it doesn't become yet another cooperatives, which are great, but often they're only great to people who are already their members, but do not do that much for the rest of the population of the city. So there's this very structural pro-systemic thinking that is smuggled into a very kind of negative media intense cause. And I think that's very rare. I mean, in this sense, if someone says this is populism, it's also worth saying it's the opposite of Brexit, right? I mean, it's not about like, let's just be against something and then no one knows what's actually happening. In a way, I mean, the movement is deeply aware that there's no such thing as a day after revolution, and that you have to prepare for what happens after you win, basically, how exactly you want to run the city and the state. And then again, in this vision of radicalism, what is important, nothing so rare, and again becomes a sign that's one of the most mature political movements, not just in Germany, I think, but in Europe or even in the world. I mean, it's on the one hand that it comes from this idea of not giving up on the power of the state. I mean, really, it is a movement that deeply believes in democracy, even against evidence sometimes, right? I mean, because to be strategic in a situation where you are in a very stark imbalance of power means that you have to use all the power that you have. You cannot, you know, you cannot be above it. You cannot say the state is all corrupt, so you're not going to engage with it. I mean, you have to find, even within the system that does not support you, find the ways to leverage the power that you have. And by invoking the German constitution, in some sense, the movement managed to leverage the conservative power of the law. I mean, by conservative power of law, it's generally a conservative institution, but that also means it conserves. I mean, it means that it preserves certain version, for example, of social democracy that has not been preserved by politics in Germany. So by leveraging this conservative power of the law, it becomes one of the most progressive initiatives in the country. And then last but not least, it is a movement that is very aware also of the power of emotions. That in a way it does this legal work, legal labor, but it also does emotional labor of organizing and of organizing support beyond the immediate political bubble. I mean, it's a very consciously a one cause movement that chose not to agree on anything but the cause of the socialization of housing. And that was not necessarily an easy thing, right? Also from the inside of the movement, because there is a long and deep tradition of the left to be very invested in small differences and also to fight each other rather than to fight together for the cause. And it costed also a tremendous amount of effort, both positive effort of community building and frankly, conflict management at times to not fall apart. I mean, in the face of conflict, to not, you know, lean into the cancelism or many forms of finding ways of splitting, but really to prevail. And it is now seven and a half years since the movement started. And obviously, if we're thinking about the second referendum, we're looking into at least 10 years. And throughout all this time, the movement has managed to preserve its energy. I mean, obviously, the number of people involved has been fluctuating at times. This is normal because sometimes there's more mobilization, sometimes less. But the fact that this movement did not die off, I mean, even after the blow of not having the referendum implemented. And there's always enough people to keep going, I mean, and to keep pushing for the next step. I mean, it's possibly the biggest success. And it's a success that leans on this emotional labor of both door-to-door campaign, of community building, of the fact that the movement has double structure. On one hand, being organized for working group, but also for heat steams, so the regional structure where people gather and be together and celebrate together. I mean, again, there was also a lot of friction between the serious work at first of law and, you know, having a fashion shows or cheerleading team. But in the end, it became very important because as one of the Brazilian activists in the movement once like very nicely put, I mean, like people come because of what they fight, but they stay because of how they feel. And the fact that the Skeets teams became also an emotional community structures allowed the movement to prevail and to really head towards the second referendum. I will read you the last bit of the first chapter. In Tenzauberg, where I live, there's a large block of streets that has only survived because some real people crafted a weapon from legal fictions. The quarter around Oderberger Straße in East Berlin was home to punk rock and political dissidents. It didn't fit the image of the socialist regime, so in the 1980s, the local government decided to demolish it. Activists saved the block by applying the laws of an authoritarian state that had written them merely to serve as cover. Leveraging formal rules of political participation, they managed, first of all, to take control of the local Von Bezirk Ausschuss, a residential district committee, the VBA. VBAs were a subdivision of the National Front of the German Democratic Republic. The National Front was an alliance of political parties and organizations that secured the supremacy of the ruling Socialist Unity Party with a pretense of collaboration. It was just a facade to make socialism appear more democratic, yet it had formal legitimacy within the system. We analyzed the laws of the GDR and found that the residential district committees could put up their own candidates to the National Front, one activist recalls. It was just that nobody had ever done that before. So in this fragment, I show how this engagement with the law as a form of dissidency has actually very long tradition in German. Or in Berlin, in East Berlin, maybe in particular. One of the activists was even elected to the Prenzlauer Berg District Assembly, which made him the first opposition MP in the GDR before the last parliamentary elections in March 1990. The group had successfully prevented the demolition, and in the block of streets that they have saved, they created the Hirschhof, a neighborhood meeting point with an open air stage. The acronym VBR was transformed into Wir bleiben alle, we are all staying put. After reunification, this became the main slogan for the housing struggle across the whole of Berlin. It often appears along with a symbol, a house raising the fist of a chimney to the sky. But in the end, not everyone did manage to stay put. Soon after the housing activists had saved their block, the people of the GDR overthrew the entire regime. East Berliners were ecstatic about their hard-won political freedom. Most had no idea at first that, as collateral for reunification, they were about to lose their homes. Today, there are hardly any former East Germans living in Prenzlauer Berg. They couldn't afford to stay. First, their buildings were reprivatized, returned to the owners who had been expropriated after the Second World War by the East German state. But because the buildings required extensive renovation, only 5 to 8% of the original owners wanted or could afford to keep them. Hardly any East Berliners could afford to buy these buildings. The income and the wealth gap between East and West was considerable. For the richest West Germans, however, the buildings were cheap. With some specially legislated tax exemptions, they were virtually free. The majority of the purchase and renovation costs became tax deductible. These tax deductions only made sense for affluent people, and so Prenzlauer Berg was effectively donated to the West German upper classes. In 1997, Der Spiegel described it as the greatest tax present of all time, and Saxony's conservative finance minister Georg Milbrandt spoke of it as capital formation for the West. East Berliners tried to keep their homes by occupying the buildings. The fact that they couldn't became a long-standing source of anger and frustration at the new system, which in this respect had not delivered on the constitutional promise of freedom. I, too, live in a house from which East Germans are long gone. I learned the history of Prenzlauer Berg from André and Matthias Bent, two scholar activists from East Berlin who became my friends. Matthias lives in a housing cooperative and has managed to stay in Prenzlauer Berg. André has moved out. Whenever I walked around the district with Matthias, he would tell me the history of every house. But neither Matthias nor Andre have ever blamed me for being a gentrifier. They believe in fixing the broken system, not putting the blame on those who come here searching for home. For Berlin to feel like home, we must keep on making it home together, East and West, migrants and Germans, those who were born here and you who have just arrived. Wir bleiben alle. We are free to stay. On the night of Andre's 47th birthday, I stayed home. I fell asleep breastfeeding my 8-week-old daughter, which was how I missed the party that, according to urban legend, became the birthplace of Deutsche Wohnen & Co. Enteignen. Of course, it couldn't just have been this one party. Revolutions start in many places at once, as if spreading through the air. Still, in certain moments and places, the air condenses and potential is transformed into energy. This is what must have happened that night at Aquarium, a venue right next to the Cotti. It was October 2017. So let me tell you what I heard. The Aquarium was packed, it must have been. Andre is Berlin's ultimate scholar activist, diligent and legendary, brilliant and humble. Electro music blasted from the speakers mixed with 1980s punk rock. The playlist will definitely have include Transmission by Joy Division. I have asked Andre about the playlist. One of Andre's all-time favorites. There is a line in the song, "The things that we've learned are no longer enough." I doubt that anyone there was thinking about the lyrics, but there were enough people who were feeling precisely this. The things that we've learned are no longer enough. That night, Tina Darling was the DJ. But the dancing didn't start until 2 a.m. because the room where it all happened was supposed to be the dance floor. Matthias was a bit irritated. He was eager to dance. He too had a small child at home, and this could be a party for once, not another work meeting. But there were so many people in the room. Apparently, Roosevelt had spent a whole vacation trying to figure out how this could work, talking it through with a bunch of friends on some Greek island. This, here, could be a perfect sounding board, a group of people who knew Berlin inside out. We will never know who was the first to come up with the idea, and it doesn't matter. By then, we all knew we had to tackle the problem at its roots. We would not be able to change the logic of finance, so we needed to shield our homes from this logic. We didn't need to smash the system, only to save our system from being smashed by the inhuman power of the corporate jabberwock. If the solution was hiding, it was hiding in plain sight. Right at the heart of the Grundgesetz lay there a four-pole sword, Article 15. It was a legal fiction of the highest order, a fundamental right forged by Germany's constituent power. This all but forgotten right allows for land, natural resources, and means of production to be made public property for the purpose of socialization. As a democratic weapon, Article 15 comes with one proviso. The socialized property must be held collectively by the people. It cannot simply be subordinated to the state. It must be democratically managed. The mighty sword of Article 15 has always been there, just like the Constitution. Suddenly, everyone wondered why we had never dared to use it. Article 15 offered a practical revolution, lawful, affordable, good. So that night, the question was not if, the question was how. That's why the dancing didn't start until 2 a.m. And after that, people didn't want to wait any longer. The DJ put on Waiting Room, a 1989 post-hardcore song by Fugazi, one of Andre's all-time favorite. And the lyric goes, "I'm planning a big surprise. I'm gonna fight for what I wanna be. And I won't make the same mistakes because I know how much time that wastes and function. Function is the key." And then they danced and danced, as if our freedom depended on it, pounding the ground to summon the Berliner spirit. And I dance with them too, until I woke up, free to be home, embracing the future. Thank you.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.